Hey legends, my name is Mo and welcome to the Can't Can World podcast. I'm a Royal Marine who is dedicated to optimizing human performance and want to bring you exposure to the fantastic people supporting the same aim. Nicknamed the Sleep Coach, my next guest has worked in elite sport for over 20 years, working with professional football teams, Team GB on the Olympic cycles, and many individual athletes on sleep and recovery with the aim of making them better tomorrow than today. If you like what you hear, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast channel for updates on new releases. And why not leave a review on your podcast provider and follow us on Instagram on the @MoMorrisRM page to show your support. Episode 22, Nick Littlehales. So is that a GB top in the background I can see? Which sport's that?
That was British Cycling back in 2012.
Oh, did you go to the, you went to the London Games, did you, with them?
Well, I started working with them around 2008-09, and that journey sort of London 2012 sort of encapsulated all their strategy of marginal gains and putting a British rider on the Tour de France podium and busting a load more world records. So
yeah. They had a pretty good games in London, if I recall, in the Velodrome.
They did, yes. They had a in the games before as well, but they certainly took it to another level then, yeah.
I remember going to the Velodrome a couple of years ago just to have a go. And you don't appreciate how steep the sides are of the track.
Yeah.
Until you see it. It's pretty incredible what they do. And I remember watching a documentary on the 2016 games with Bradley Wiggins and whoever the cycling coach at the time was running them at world record pace in practice. And there was like a little bit of a disagreement between athlete and coach saying this is not sustainable, but then obviously they went out and did the business in 2016 as well. It's exciting stuff.
It was a really interesting time back then.
So you are well known for your work in the field of sleep and recovery. So where did that all start? How did you get into that field in the first place?
Just some very strange sort of personal circumstances. I was, I'm 61 years of age now. So it was way back in the sort of late 70s, early 80s when I was just trying to get into any sport I possibly could. Fell out of that, got married, joined the furniture business, family furniture business, pay the bills and the mortgage and stuff. Ended up working for a company called Slumberland, who was in making sleeping products and stuff like that. Graduated through their ranks quite quickly to become their international sales and marketing director. It was a big brand, licensees all over the world. So we're always trying to push the boundaries and innovate and lead. That led me to create the very first sleep council with some collaborative partners, which I was the chairman of because there wasn't one. And I got involved with all aspects of sleep and sleeping, and collaborated with some clinical professors of sleep. And I suppose I hit a particular point of midlife 40s crisis and just realized that, it was a pretty sad industry. There were so many things, so many contradictions, so many sort of things about it. That's why people just took it for granted. And I'd learned a lot and none of it really made too much sense. And it was just in my final year working for the company as a director that I happened to do something quite unusual, which was the local football club called Oldham Athletic. My UK office was in Northwest Manchester in Oldham. And they knocked on my door one day because we were a big employer in the area to see if we'd sponsor the shirts. So I just took a decision to say yes. And a lot of the workforce were fans of the club. So it was a kind of nice thing to do for the workers. And it was in the very early stages of, sponsorship things going on in the front of football shirts. So it created a lot of interest because the company Slumberland, who makes beds and sleep, was on the front of a football shirt. And so the media kind of found that rather funny. And so I got invited to some local football events because I was the guy who wrote out the check. Unaware at the time that that's the Northwest clubs, Bury and and Oldham were the breeding ground of players for Manchester United. So I happened to find myself in the company of Alex Ferguson. You know, you have to talk about something. So I was just asking questions about, you know, does he think about sleep with the players and stuff like that? I think it'd have been any other club anywhere on the planet, any other manager at the time, that conversation would have stopped and started with the glass of wine that we were drinking. But he became a little bit intrigued about some of the things I said. I can't even remember what I did say, but that sparked off asking the club, his coaches, you know, what do we do about the players when they're away from us, sleeping and stuff like that? Do we actually look at that? It's very early days of sort of sports science in some respects. There was Alex Ferguson and a manager called Sam Allardyce were very much at the forefront of, you know, getting other things in to improve performance and things like that. So I had a conversation with the physio who was very interested from a physical aspect of sleeping. And that guy was Dave Fever. We did a few things with one of the players. That led to me talking to the squad and sort of getting a little bit involved. My company was just not interested in what I was doing. So it was literally just me having a bit of fun in my final year, happened to be talking to a big football club. A lot of those players at the time played for the England national squad. So they started talking to the England national squad coaches about this guy who comes in and talks to us about beds and sleep and stuff. And that triggered off another little bit of coincidence, to be honest, that Arsene Wenger, a French bespectacled maverick of sports coaching at that particular time, had joined Arsenal. And the England physio at the time was also Arsenal's physio. So Gary Lewin was his name, and he asked me to go into the club. Arsene Wenger had a completely different approach. And so that was my first real audience with a first team squad. So that's when I really had to sort of come up with, you know, what am I doing? How am I doing it? You know, how are we going to put this across? So it was really weird that it just happened, because in those days, you know, the newspapers and stuff, they got wind of what was going on, and it was a bit of a joke, really, you know, that Manchester United and England squad players and Arsenal Football Club have got a guy talking to them about sleep, those pampered players. So I was given the title as a sleep coach for football by the media. So I just thought, you know, what does that mean? How am I going to do it? The Arsenal team at the time was completely different to Manchester United, very multicultural. So it threw up all sorts of things. So my journey just started, and here we are today.
How was it going into Arsenal at the time? Because Arsenal's my club, so I, okay, you know, I don't have detailed information on them, but I do follow them. I follow them for many, many years now. And I remember when Arsene Wenger took over, the culture at the club was certainly different to what Arsene Wenger wanted to take it in the direction. So when he's obviously the gaffer's got someone in to talk to the players, and there were a few players at the time that were very liberal with their extracurricular, shall we say. How did that go down with that squad? What was it like when you were talking to them, if you can remember? Were they receptive? Were they like, how did it work?
Well, it's sort of back in the day when I can't remember if I even had a phone. You know, this is, I mean, the World Cup was 1998 in France. So it would probably have been about 1999. So, you know, so I haven't got the history record of having a mobile phone with a camera on it with me. And you weren't taking notes. But what I remember vividly about it was that Gary Lewin was extremely positive about the subject, always had been, but hadn't really found a way of trying to introduce it or how you'd introduce it. Arsene Wenger, as you said, came in and immediately, you know, set the new rules. So it was either you do it my way or you go. So they were very much of that sort of Alex Ferguson ilk, like, this guy's coming in, you're all going in the room and you need to listen and learn because this is the future, right? But as you said, there were some characters in the room. I can't remember all of them, but Adebayor and Gael Clichy, Thomas Ruzicki, Cesc Fabregas, Henri. And because it was a very sort of naive workshop in a sense, and there's me talking to all these young multimillionaire lads who got no fear. And basically, they just did like most people did, like the media. It was like, you know, will it improve my sex life? Or, yeah, all that sort of general boys' own stuff was going on. They did have a few moments when they were mucking about because I took some product with me, some bits and bobs about helping physical postural support as far as physio is concerned. So they did take the opportunity to take the mickey out of me and the subject. But I remember it one particular during the course of the presentation. I think it got a little bit, you know, boisterous. Not in a bad way. It was just the kind of questions were obviously asked to create some sort of laughter in the room. But Thierry Henry sort of raised a hand and told everybody to, in kind words, shut up and concentrate on what this guy is doing, because if the manager's brought him in, then this is worth listening to. So there was a little bit of the commander in Henry bringing the troops together and all that sorts of stuff. But no, inevitably, there were three or four players who came straight away from that and engaged my services privately. Gael Clichy was one, Thomas Ruzicki was another. And it was just, it did open up conversations within the club and in other areas like the England squad, which ended up leading me, you know, shortly after for the Euro 2000s in Portugal, 2004. Where I literally got engaged with the England squad in a full way with Sven-Goran Eriksson and his team doctor and the things. And that's when we did a really big sort of sleep recovery thing that went on, because it was quite unique because they had one hotel for the whole championships because they were just traveling in and out, which is not normal. So they were able to take that hotel over completely. So I actually went into the hotel and made a number of changes, even shipped products over there, chose rooms for particular players. And, you know, for the sake of sort of Zinedine Zidane, if anybody can remember it, we would have beaten France in the first match, and I was in the stadium at the time. And that would have been a great kickstart to the sort of sleep career in the England squad, but that wasn't to be. But, yeah, it's been a slow burn, you know. In many cases, because it's taken for granted, it's not a performance criteria. So it always is a health pillar tagged onto the others. So it was a bit sort of, you know, can't really get too involved with this, because it's basically the players when they're sleeping are not with the club. You know, they're sort of either in a hotel room on their own or they're at home. And nobody knows anything about it. So it was really difficult to sort of look at it in a sort of high performance way. But there was lots of people, you know, step by step, knocking on the door, and we were getting successes, things were shifting, things were changing, and, you know, sports science started to creep in and data collection and all that sort of stuff started to become more prevalent. People started looking at diets and nutrition and peripheral vision and all sorts of aspects. The stress and anxiety sort of mental health and well-being area started to open up because, you know, everybody in the stadium's a reporter now with a camera. And so there was lots of other pressures with technology and things like that coming in around the sport. So, and then, you know, like pointed out before, British cycling got challenged to put a British rider on the Tour de France podium and reinvigorate cycling. There's two reasons for that: to get the whole population out cycling and be healthy, because they've got something to look up to. But they had a five-year plan, and it was basically, you know, Sir Dave Brailsford now and a team of coaches, the best around the world. And it was all about the aggregation of marginal gains. And that means they have to look at absolutely everything to try and find those little 1% factors that could, you know, make the difference on the day. And they couldn't ignore sleep. I was the only person from a non-clinical sort of side, non-intrusive type of way, that had something to offer. So I got involved with them. And that's really where the sort of, because that was one of the only things that they'd not investigated before. So they did everything down to the fine detail like they did before. But then when it came to sleep, they'd not done that before. So that was really one of the areas, like human recovery, that was very much pointed out to a lot of other organizations, that that was one of the key factors that was never in place before and seemed to give them that edge on more consistent, sustainable levels of performance and doing things that are a little bit non-human. So it was kind of, if you put sleep first as the health pillar, change your perception of it, how you define it, then if you get that sort of recovery activity rhythm right or better, then everything else you do will be optimized. If it's at the back end of doing everything and then just go to bed and get some sleep and I'll see you tomorrow, then basically everything that you're trying to do is never going to be quite as good as it possibly could. So it started to reveal that there is a group of players, there's a group of riders, there's an individual athlete, a runner, a sprinter, and you've got a group of them that are all, you know, they're all at the high peak, sort of at Olympic level type thing. But then one or two of them would just step beyond that and just be able to grab something more than others when it mattered. And that was really pointed down to their approach to recovery. So that's when it started to gather a bit more momentum that, you know, it's not a waste of time. It shouldn't be taken for granted. There is a different way to approach it, and it can have enormous impact on your personal performance, you know, whatever sport it is or whatever it is in life. So that's when it started to get a bit more interesting.
I've got to go back to something you said. So does it improve your sex life?
I think what it generally does is it improves everything you do, you know, because sometimes these very emotional and things like, you know, having sex with somebody else, that very sort of personal interaction and stuff, those things can get really disturbed by just mood, motivation and things like that, you know, other things going on. And it's sort of, I think a good approach to recovery creates a much more balanced you. And so, yes, you know, everything improves.
What was it like working in British Cycling at that time?
I was sort of involved with it, but I was kind of like also on the outside of it as well. So all the main was about all the training programs and all the other stuff and the equipment and all that and the coaches and everything else. So, but what was just, you know, looking back at it, this sort of aggregation of marginal gains, it was kind of like, how do you get your head around that? Because it becomes a sort of almost obsessive compulsive disorder, because you start thinking about what shampoo you're washing your hair with. You start thinking about the friction between the footwear you've got walking around the training center, dragging energy out of you. If you change, you know, you change the surface of the bottom of a shoe, would it create less friction? Would it take less energy out of the legs? You started, and strangely enough, which has been, highlighted quite specifically over the last few years. I was there and they were teaching them how to wash their hands, you know, singing happy birthday, whatever it might be. But the whole thing about the control of viruses, because you go on a grand tour for 3 weeks, you might pick something up in a hotel or from another rider, and that might not reveal itself for a week just when you don't want it to. So they became very conscious about, you know, how everybody was interacting, right down to, you know, when you wash your hands, there's a way of doing it, which means your hands are clean of bacteria or whatever it might be. If you just do it like that normally, you might as well not do it. So it was kind of, what on earth have these things got to do with? But then when you started to see, you've got to, a lot of it is not about the individual athlete's natural ability and the equipment and everything else. And like you mentioned, you know, if you go into a velodrome, you suddenly realize, wow, that's a sport, because of the steepness of the velodrome size, and it's a real technique. So it was very much more to, if we can keep all the riders available to train and do stuff and recover and everything else, if we can keep them more consistently there, then when they get there, they're going to be more consistently better. If we're always hopping out with an injury or an illness or something like that, it breaks the whole process up. So the whole thing was designed to make sure that you could do this 24/7, 1 month after next, and to, you know, the only way you can do that is have consistency in your overall approach. And that would be to reduce anything that could get in the way.
I mean, that's a pretty extreme example of controlling the controllables, but it's arguable that it worked, because I think it was something like 4 out of 5 seasons, tours, when they, I think the first year they crashed, Wiggins crashed out. And then after that, it was Wiggins. And then I think Froome won it for 3 years on the bounce. It was like, yeah. So they did. It obviously worked. And they stole a march on the rest of the teams. Yeah.
Well, they were sort of, they started to do well. I think it was Beijing or something. They started to show the signs. And you've got a group of male and female riders on the track and the road that was really starting to push those boundaries. And they were very much getting labelled of, you know, they must be doing something that's illegal, because they kept breaking world records and continued to do so for a period of time. But it was, you know, I think that's something I think everybody should be conscious of, because of all the people I get to coach and everything else, is, you know, you'd find it hard to come across a triathlete or a marathon runner a couple of decades ago, unless you were a major championship, you know. Now there's probably 4 or 5 in every street. You know, everybody's doing marathons or half marathons. There's triathletes who've not only got full-time jobs, Ironmans, all sorts of things. So I think generally we get a little bit obsessive about, you know, the ultimate performance. And like I said before, it can so easily become very OCD that you literally start thinking about absolutely everything. And when you start thinking about absolutely everything, it kills the natural talent. It changes your whole perspective. And sometimes, you know, if you're not able to wash your hands properly, sort of thing, before you're going to go onto that track and perform, you almost think you're going to fail.
Almost because the ritual's not been carried
out. Yeah, yeah. It's like suddenly starting taking sleeping tablets. And then basically you think you can't sleep without taking the tablet. And if you take the tablet away, you've got no chance. They become those sort of rituals that is very, very difficult to maintain, you know, because you do have to travel around. So at certain points, it was quite a serious operation to take anybody anywhere, you know, because of that. That's why I was asked to design, you know, we looked at it and said, well, you know, all the riders sleep in their homes. This is what their homes look like. This is their bedrooms. These are the kind of things they sleep on and with. These are their partners. Some have got kids, some haven't. And some are in flats, some are in houses. But then you take them to an Olympic Village and there's none of that there. Or on a Tour de France, you know, it's a different hotel every night. And there could have been a hen night in that hotel the night before. And so it's that sort of whole, so we started to look at, you know, these are some of the key things that they've all got. Put those into a kit bag. Take that kit bag into every hotel. Bypass the mattress, bypass the bed. We then started, you know, going around with that sort of very powerful handheld vacuum cleaner and cleaning the room much better. High particle filters in the corner of the room to drag all the crap out of the air. Wiping all the surfaces down. And it was like trying to create an environment where an athlete would go to recover.
What sort of psychological impact does that have for the athlete, though? Because, I mean, if you are knowing that you've got a logistical team in any domain, really, that's going in to prepare at that type of detail and level, does that have a positive effect on the athlete where they're like, they feel part of something that's bigger than them? And does it raise their game, even the act alone? I mean, how much of that do you think would be placebo as opposed to actual recovery beneficial, if that makes sense?
Well, it's kind of two sides to that, to be honest. You know, if you can't measure it in sport, you probably don't do it. You know, it's very much like that. But in this particular area, we decided not to bring in, you know, trackers, sleep trackers, things like that, because what was very apparent was that because it was about the logistics and everybody's involved, that's one thing. But what it was about was actually what we were doing, because you come off a day, 200 kilometers, you're massaging, fueling up and things like that, and going through, breaking down what was good and about the day. And then at some point, you've got to go up to that hotel room. Now, that hotel room has got some bed in it and some pillows, and it's all like that. And it's not really, I've got to go there and recover and then go and do this again. And so they were kind of hesitant about going to bed. They knew how important the recovery was, but it was like going into somewhere that's unfamiliar. So you can imagine, even while they're on the road doing those 200 Ks, they know that when they end that stage and they go in and do all of that, they can't wait to get upstairs and get into a recovery state, because there's their sleep kit. They know what it smells like. They've been using it at home. It's got familiar this, it's familiar that. We've cleaned the place out. We've made it, you know, it's even like we've put the teddy bear in there. We've put the you know, and we've done other things like, you know, just recording on their devices, talking, you know, reading bedtime stories to the kids. Things have moved on a bit, but just have that on their device so they can just put the pods in and just literally transport themselves to, you know, something that's really calming and natural. So it was kind of like what everybody noticed, that everybody was happier. Everybody was more motivated to get recovery. They love that fact. And even to the point that in a peloton, anybody who knows about cycling at that level, but the reason why the team's there, and it's not just one, is during the course of any stage, they're all protecting each other, or protecting the sprinter, or protecting the mountain climber, or whatever. So when you're inside the peloton, basically, you're having a nap, because you're not pedaling as much, you're not taking the wind, you're not getting the buffering of the wind either side of you. So when you go into the middle, that's a recovery period for a few kilometers, and then you might end up at the front. You know, so it's kind of like, is that a nap? Well, yeah, it's a mental and physical recovery period during the course of a stage of the Tour of France. And it's sort of like, all right, okay, well, that's that. So it really started to build up, and all we knew is everybody was just so much happier, you know? Everybody just seemed so much happier. So we're not going to measure this. We don't need to measure this, because It's happening right in front of us. That we can see what they're like in the mornings. We can see how certain injuries are sort of clearing up a little bit quicker, or they can manage it, or they're asking for less painkillers, or they're scoffing all their meals off and they're going up to bed and sleeping and waking up in the morning doing this, and they're less agitated. And then, of course, you know, it all adds up that they start doing what they're actually there to do and achieving their targets. So we just, the last thing we want to do is start measuring it, you know, because it's, all it's going to do is put another level of sort of intrusive anxiety. Well, I'm doing all of this, but I'm not really sleeping well, according to this tracker that's guessing, you know. But it was just a fascinating period of time. But I think there was a lot learnt during the course of that, which a lot of organisations adopt today. But they, I wouldn't say that that particular approach has gone away, but the intensity of that approach has certainly been diluted.
Why do you think that is?
It's just too intrusive. I think there's that thing of, you know, it's very much around with the people I work around who've been great advocates from every time they were to collect data and collect data and do it and do it and do it. Madness of it. But now they really understand that to reveal natural human talent, to reveal human performance, to manage that, you know, health and well-being, and that mental health and well-being of any individual athlete, to be able to work with them and to keep them at that level, then if you go into too much, too intrusively into their worlds, then that just slows the whole process down. You might even lose them and they might not make it, you know?
It's almost like you have to drop enough breadcrumbs for them to be intuitive to do it themselves, as opposed to force them to do it.
Yeah, definitely. So that they tend to identify that the data that they will actually react to and can do something with, and focus on that data and be careful about going too far. So you sort of look at that and think, well, that's all right, but there's so many variables around sleeping that is very much about everything you do from the point of wake. You know, when you present yourself to any recovery period, like nocturnal sleep, your brain takes over and you're out of control. So what you need to understand is what things will trigger and help your brain that when you do ask it to take you into a sleep state, you need to know when is the best time for that to happen. How do you help your brain to get to that particular point? Because it doesn't matter how many hours you allocate to sleep. You know, get your 8 hours. Yes, well, I've allocated 8 hours. Yeah, but what happens during those 8 hours is out of your control. So it's kind of like, just because you allocate the time doesn't mean to say you're going to do it. It's like, you know, I've got a 2-hour gym session, but I just go there and sit on the bench. You can allocate as much time as you want, but you've got to actually be able to do it, and you're not in control of it. So I think there's lots of things go on. You know, sometimes you can't sleep, too much adrenaline, cortisol, worried about stuff, things happen, temperature changes, summer, winter, you know, in a hotel, out of a hotel, a bit of an illness or something like that. Or, you know, you do have a regular sleeping partner and you sort of wake up in the middle of the night and decide you're going to play with each other. And that's going to come up on the data that you had a high heart rate or you were awake. Or so it kind of like, why do we want to bring this into our day? It's like there's already a medical term for sleep tracking without the experience of what you're looking at and what does it mean and how you could change it, which is orthoinsomnia. So it's already got a term that it creates more anxiety and stress because you're sort of waking up in the morning and then looking at data of what was happening while you were asleep. Whereas every other sort of data collection, you know, heart rate variability and all that sort of stuff, is you're actually physically doing something mentally and physically, and you can see what's happening, and then you can adjust it a little bit and see if you can improve it against good research and good data that's been generated over decades and centuries. But if you're only if you're only getting sort of like 5% deep sleep and the tracker's guessing that, and you had 24 awakenings and only 6.25 hours or in supposedly sleep state, what are you going to do with that information?
I think it's a really good point because, you know, the work that we've done in Maya and human performance, we speak to people like Professor Andy McCann, who has been pivotal to informing us and educating us on sleep and recovery as being paramount for performance rather than planning in your physical sessions. And then what most people will do is they would just go to sleep at the end of a day and start between when they need to go to, or they end up going to bed and when they need to wake up, rather than what you said is in planning it in. And what you find is that you have a lot of people that are wearing sleep trackers now, accurate or not, you know, depending on brand, but they don't know what to do with that information in the first instance. And I was looking on your website and I thought it was really, really clever and sensible, if nothing else, that you've listed the stages and information that people need to understand and context behind what sleep actually does and why it's there. Because if you don't know why it's there, it doesn't matter what the data is telling you, because you can never get to what your optimal sleep recovery should be. And I think, you know, there is a complete mismatch with people's basic understanding of how important sleep is measured against someone's intent to better it, but not through data that they don't understand.
There's always a lot of variables, but I think the sort of addictive behavior is very much on the increase. And I don't mean sort of hard drugs in that sense, but diving into any sort of isolated intervention that can help with their concern about recovery or sleep. And that's growing like mad. Like, you know, the sort of top 10 sleeping tablets that you'd have to, you know, drag off a doctor or GP under extreme circumstances and only use for a 7-day period, not to repeat. You can just get them online delivered to your house. You know, lots of variations of supplements with all sorts of things. Caffeine's always been around, and energy drinks and cultural things like snus, which is a little nicotine tobacco pouch that goes under the top lip. And I think, you know, with all of those things going, that's really where it's sort of not in our DNA to go and talk to a sleep coach. I don't even know what one is. To go to a sleep clinic now, you've got to have a proper disorder to get referred. The doctor will tell you to get a bit more exercise, eat healthier. They can't really do too much definitive about it. So I think the thing that really changes is this sort of, you know, the real game changers that we have around us. There's lots of things that are classified as game changers, but is that when you suddenly, just a very simple process is what should be educated in schooling, and therefore parents pass it on and everybody else. And that means, you know, universities and schools and business owners and everybody has got that little bit more awareness of what it's all about. And that's really where the sort of success factor comes in, is the first thing you just do is a very simple personal journey of the 7 key sleep recovery indicators, which I have found to be that little key step process that brings you to a place where you can create your definitive approach. And you can also be far more considered about what type of interventions you might add to that to improve it, just like anything else. And one is just tap circadian rhythms in your browser and just remind yourself you're a human being with a brain. You're on a planet which the sun goes around, and these things never change. And we should be more synchronized with that rolling 24-hour process, particularly about light, dark, and diminished light. Serotonin and melatonin production, which is part of that process, which drives you as a human being in your brain. So chronotypes, whether you're a morning or nighttime person, because it's a little genetic twist. You know, it's not, you can override it, camouflage it, ignore it if you want. But the main thing you really want to do is is understand it and manage it, because you can, you know, you don't want to end up lots of things in your life with friends and colleagues or coaches or anybody. Is all of those dynamics are going on, and it's always fighting against your natural rhythm. So if you know your natural rhythm, it doesn't mean to say you have to change everything, but you're able to do things prior to certain things or after certain things to protect you. If your best mate is a nighttime chronotype and you're a morning chronotype, they want to go to the gym in the evening and you want to go in the morning. Now, you may still want to do that, yeah? But there's some things you need to do before the evening session, and there's certain things that need to do before the morning session. Otherwise, you're not getting the benefits from what you're trying to do. In cycles, you know, you just tap it in your browser, polyphasic sleeping for human brain. It's at the end of your fingertips. We only tried to sleep in one block when we invented electric light. You know, so up until then, we had a much more polyphasic approach to our 24 hours, where we had more recovery opportunities, not just to sleep, but recovery opportunities. We were far more in tune with the natural rhythms. Anybody who wakes up in the middle of the night at 2 o'clock in the morning and can't get back to sleep would then understand that that's perfectly natural and stop worrying about it, right? And then you suddenly start, you get this relationship with rhythm and pattern. So if you're in a clinic, in a sleep clinic, and they're tracking your brainwave patterns going through all the various sleep stages, how your brain develops that as you enter sleep, and most would look at 60 minutes against the next 60 minutes. But a lot of the professors would look at 90 minutes. And they would see that the development of those stages are a little bit more, detailed. And then the next 90 minutes and the next 90 minutes. So 5 90-minute cycles is 7.5 hours. 15 minutes in, 15 minutes out is your 8. 8 hours is approximately 30% of the 24-hour clock. And 5 90-minute cycles, there's your 8. So you then think, right, what's the most key thing that my brain and my relationship with circadian rhythms and the sun is sunrise? Because sunrise brings the planet to life and kicks everything off. And daylight, blue light, is all about doing everything active. And then when it disappears, you move into a different phase called diminished light. So within the 4 phases of the day, and you're a human being, and you just get a consistent start to your day, right? So it's like mine is 6:30. So the alarm goes on for 6:30. Now I will wake before 6:30 and switch it off. So it's not my consistent wake time, it's my consistent start to my daytime. Right? And it's only there because I'm not in control of my sleep when I'm asleep. So it's only there as a little bit of protection that I don't go past that point. But inevitably, when you get any rhythm, I will wake at some point between 5 o'clock and 6:30, which is the last 90-minute cycling to the start of my day. And I will wake at some point during that period and then start the day around 6:30. And then what I'm done is chop the day up into 90-minute cycles. That gives you 16 cycles, and that gives you the first cycle of the day and the second cycle of the day and the third cycle of the day, and it takes you all the way around to the 16th cycle, and that is the final cycle before you start cycle one again on repeat. So you start to get this start of the day. What do you do in the first cycle of your day, right? And that's everything that you should do. Loads of light for serotonin to be built up, to unsuppress everything. You know, hydrate up, bowel and bladder, fuel yourself up, give yourself some space to be able to do those things, little mental challenges, right? Second cycle, what's that about? You know, little tiny recovery periods, like a couple of minutes every cycle. Just look out the window for a couple of minutes. Only half fill your hydration bottle up, so you're always popping to refill it. Creating little tiny recovery moments, that's all helping the process. And then you start thinking about a little 30-minute cycle, a 30-minute period inside maybe cycle number 7 or number 8, because that's late afternoon. And a little 30-minute period for you, because that's 30-odd% of the 90-minute cycle, a little 30-minute period of you just, you know, shutting yourself down, vacant mind space. Don't even try and sleep. You can fall asleep behind the wheel of a car. What's that all about? That's nuts. So you don't have to force sleep. Your brain will do it if it's got rhythm and if it's comfortable and if you're helping it. So sometimes my little 30 minutes at the end of the day, you know, late afternoon, everybody will shout and go, I ain't got time for that. I haven't got time for that. Can't fit that in. We waste so much time that it's how important it is, you know. And that little 30 minutes takes all the pressure off the next phase in the evening. I'm not rushing around trying to get everything done and shut my tech down and put my blue blocker glasses on. And I can't go for a swim at 9 o'clock because that's too late. Or I can't eat at 9:30 because that's too close to 11 o'clock and I won't get my 8 hours in and I can't do this. And just go, what I'll do, which suits me, is the way my cycles look is I'm going to allocate 4 cycles nocturnally between 12:30 and 6:30. That's 6 hours. I want to roll through that without any disturbances. I want to give my brain the opportunity to reveal all the good stuff, the deep sleep stuff and everything else, which I'll only do in the first cycle because the first cycle looks like that, looking for deep sleep. The second 90-minute cycle is looking for deep sleep. The third, fourth, and fifth is all about waking up because that's how it works. That's why it's 2 o'clock in the morning. It's not 2 o'clock at night. It's 2 a.m. You know, it's after midnight. It's the planet is getting ready to wake up. So suddenly you start to think the first 2 cycles of my sleep, you know, I really want to be helping the brain throughout all the other cycles to go and get that and then stay in a sleep state for 3, 4, 5. But it's light sleep. So anybody's got a tracker and they look at it or an app and goes, I don't get any deep sleep after 3 o'clock. How am I going to improve that? They say, well, you won't, because it will never get revealed there. It only gets revealed there, you know? So, you know, to sort of waffle on about your question, you suddenly start to get a lovely rhythm to, you know, any coach who wants somebody to change what they do, is don't tell them to do it. You take them on a little journey and they end up there. So with anybody outside of sport, in any walk of life, whether you're a parent, a teacher, in the forces, you're a night shift worker, you're a multi-shift worker, is don't just keep randomly getting on with it. As you can use that system, that little own personal coaching system, it's just there with you all the time, completely subconscious. So I've got little timings in my head I don't even have to think about. So if I need to get up earlier than 6 o'clock, 6:30, if I need to start my day earlier than 6:30, I go back to 5 o'clock. Any more than that, I go back to 3:30 or to 2 a.m. or to 12:30 or to 11, right? So suddenly, because I like to work on the hour or half an hour because it's dead easy to think about, suddenly you start to go, right, that's probably my most consistent start to my day, right? And if you're a nighttime chronotype, that's probably 2 full cycles earlier than you'd like. You'd like to be actually starting your day at maybe 9 or 10 o'clock if you're a nighttimer. But you have to start the day with everybody else in this AM's world. So it might have to be at 6 o'clock. But immediately you know that your most consistent start time to your day is based on your occupation or other things. But it is 2 full cycles to when you'd naturally do it. So it's really important, the first cycle of your day, because you're dragging yourself into the world. And you need to know how to do that collectively. Otherwise, that's going to be going on all morning and into the afternoon. And you need to know if you still want to be awake at 1 o'clock at night, because you feel awake and creative because you're a night timer, then how do you factor that in? So suddenly the whole thing just becomes, you can sort of think 35 cycles a week, 5 a day. That's 7.5 hours. I'm not going to get it all in one block nocturnally. I'm not going to go crazy, but 6 hours all the way through, lots of good stuff, nice and balanced. That's better than spending 8 and most of it tossing and turning. That sounds good. All the little breaks add up. Little ones, just look out the window, you know, for 2 minutes. Helps the brain. 30-minute cycle there. Brilliant inside of that one. Means I can deal with winter and summer when the clocks change and all the light changes and all this sort of stuff. I can deal with birthday parties. I can deal with planes getting delayed. I can get cars breaking down. I can get friends going, come on, let's go riding our bikes tonight. I say yes, not no, because I just shift to the next cycle and have a short, have three cycles into the same start time. Do the same thing in the first cycle, second cycle, third cycle, but then might drop in a little 20-minute one midday, because that's the other recovery, as well as my 30-minute one, just to stop me going to bed earlier or sleeping in later, trying to catch up. I do it 7 days a week. What, even on your days off? What, the most important day of the week? My day off. I don't want to be in recovery catch-up on my days off. I want to be up, start my day at 6:30 and smash it and go and have loads of fun, you know. So it's a 7 day a week thing. So you start thinking 35 cycles a week. Mine is made up of 28 nocturnal cycles back to back, four a night. It's made up of at least 6 to 7 CRPs every day, little 2 minute ones every cycle. And you've got 7 30-minute periods within the seventh or eighth. So my sleep has got nothing to do with Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. It starts with the first cycle of my day. It starts at 6:30. I go through 16 cycles in every 24 hours on repeat. And I'll just keep rolling with that and just keep managing that, knowing that as long as it's in that area of like 28 back-to-back 90-minute cycles, and there's 7 30-minute cycles in there, little periods in there late afternoon, and as long as, then I'm absolutely fine. If I look at a particular day in a few days' time, a particular period, and it looks like there's too many things pointing in the wrong direction, I'm not even going to try and sleep, because that it's just going to be annoying, right? So I'll just, on the 2 days running into that period, I'll just add a little one in there, little one in there, do that, and go, you know, change one or two little behavior things in the evening before to take the pressure off trying to get into bed and going to sleep. And because you take all that pressure away, you might just get a couple of cycles into 6:30 in, because your brain just is happy trying to force it. So that's why you just ask yourself the question, don't you? Even just stop worrying about it, because it's its biggest disruptor. Create a natural rhythm, a recovery rhythm to your day. You'll be more productive. You'll go faster. You'll smile. You'll deal with the pressures much better. You'll deal with the positive things and maximize those better. You'll stop worrying about it. You'll start to realize that by default, now things, you know, suddenly you realize that actually you're recovering far more than just trying to do your 8 hours at night and not really achieving it. And suddenly, you know, you just very much quickly reflect on just, you have become a different person, you know. Maybe not so dramatic as that, but you've been in a sort of shadow of who you really could be. And that's your personal best. That's your success factors. That's what you achieve. And it could be extremely high and successful. But there's another version of you just there, right? And that one is more resilient. And that one is because you put recovery as your first health pillar, not leave it at the back end.
Is there a difference, any biological difference between genders? And is there any biological difference between different ages when we come to sleep volumes and cycles?
Two questions there. The first one is when, as humans, when we're born, the brain is completely in control of the formative growth years. So that means, as an infant, you are kept in a sleep state by your brain are basically about those hormones, serotonin, that don't get produced. So you get kept in that thing. So you'll be sleeping for 18 hours a day, right? And you'll just pop out of that, fuel up, change your nappy, hydrate, and off you go again, right?
Sounds amazing.
I know, it doesn't. And as you sort of, you know, 1 year old, 2 year old, 3 year old, it starts to shift, you know, 16 hours, 15, it starts to shift down. And you get to sort of into your 11, 12, and you're moving towards that adolescence. And that's when you start to shift into this 8 hours a day type scenario. Not because your brain's giving up on you, it's just because you've developed into sort of adulthood. Then there's lots of other things that now put you in a pattern. One, your parents want you to be sleeping monophasically as quickly as possible to give them some space to watch the telly and have a meal together, not because it's good for them. The second thing is you start to, you know, all those other things start to come in and you hit the air. As you rock on, the only thing, a lot of people say that when you get older, you don't need much sleep. There are some little indications, but the main thing for me is your behavior changes, right? You probably haven't got a job anymore. You're sort of semi-retired. You don't care about stuff as much as you used to. You know, you probably have more time for social activities than you ever used to. You know, instead of rushing to work, you get up and take the dog for a walk. So I think what it happens is that the sort of intensity about the amount of sleep, and you're probably likely, you know, to, you know, sit down on the garden bench or something, or I'm not talking about in your 70s and 60s. You know, it's sort of, you probably take more time out for yourself because you're in that stage of your life rather than when you were 30 or 20. So I don't think it's about how much sleep we need. I think it's just probably the quality and the way we get the sleep starts to shift just because of our behavior. The other question is, yeah, you know, genders, females, I think I've got about a 10 degree difference in body temperature. What does that mean, you know, to men generally? They are certainly, whether they like kids or not, they have that nurturing tendency. And so they are more alert, more sensitive, and more aware. So when you know, women's sport, female sport is really kicking the boundaries now out there, but it wasn't like that before. They always played sport, but it's not like it is today. So you are able to explore those gender differences, but you, in a very sort of, not the obvious one, oh, it's the menstrual cycle. It's very much about understanding certain principles about how you get recovery. And a lot of females will they won't, it's not necessarily use the word struggle, but it's very easy for them to, however many hours they allocate to sleep, is basically that the brain only reveals light sleep stages because they're remaining, so they are sleeping, they are getting recovery, but they're getting the majority of it's light sleep, because that's a bit like, you know, there is an infant in a cot in another room. As soon as that infant starts to move, right, the rustle of a blanket, the female is alert, right? Because the next thing is crying. The next thing is standing up against the side of the cot, screaming, right? So that little tiny thing, very sensitive like that, so they can get in and catch it and calm them back into a sleep state. For a man, that child has got out of the cot, come into the bed, and he's banging on my head, you know? And I'm going, what? So it's kind of, you know, to use an exaggerated example, but it's kind of like that sensitivity. So when you're looking at hotels, when you're looking at where the bedroom is, where you're looking at other things in your bedroom, when you're looking at all sorts of factors, when two humans come together, whatever gender balance that is, you've got to be very aware that as humans, we're not actually designed to sleep with other humans. We like the sex, we like the security, we like the spooning, we like to have our partner close to us in that very sort of intimate space. But at the end of the day, most people would reflect that when they start to enter a sleep state, they will just turn away from each other and curl up in a fetal position and just go, I'll see you later, but not any sooner. So it's kind of the differences between the genders in all sorts of ways can be quite specific. I think the danger is sometimes to make it too specific. But you do, I think, be conscious that when it comes to recovery, not doing their sport, they're not more sensitive and aware and all that sort of stuff doing their sport, but very much in their own space, in that sort of recovery space, you have to be conscious that their ability to recover is very easily diminished if you don't take certain things into account, and particularly them, you know?
I think it's interesting that you mentioned about the sleep cycles and looking at 90 minutes. Like most of the literature that I would read would talk about your nighttime 90 minutes, not necessarily your daytime 90 minutes. Yeah. So that's quite interesting. So then how would that then work if you talk about when you go past midnight, the world is, or certainly your part of the world is getting ready to wake up.
Mm-hmm.
What about those that do shift work on nighttime work? I mean, that's probably quite challenging for them to get that right when they're supposed to be they've got to be asleep when the world's awake, so to speak, and then mm-hmm. awake when the world's asleep.
Well, that's it. You know, that's why a lot of things that, you know, you would normally hear, you know, get your 8 hours. If you get six, you're going to die. Don't eat too late. Bedrooms at 16 to 18 degrees. Consistent sleep time. Consistent wake time. And get your 8 hours at night. And go, well, I can't do that. I can't even try to do that. And so there's always been that sort of night shift thing. But now we've got multi-shifts all the public sector, you know, the police force, the fire services, the NHS, they're all working crazy non-human shifts, you know, 3 days of this, 2 days of that, 5 days of that. I've done quite a bit of work with some police forces and fire services and even on into the military. And it's just like, you just can't go from three night shifts to 2 day shifts and all this sort of stuff. But when you look at it, what doesn't change is sunrise. You've got a consistent start to your day. That's where you stand. So if you set that out very early on in life, you know, adolescence, early teens, right? That's my chronotype. That's my start to my day, right? The next thing that comes along is an occupation. And you go, okay, I'm going to be a pilot. Well, as an AMO, do short haul. Be a pilot, but short haul, not long haul, because long haul will ruin you, because you don't like shifts like that, flying through. As a morning chronotype, you don't like that. So you're constantly working. So you'll burn out after 10 years if you do that. So be a pilot, but be conscious of that. Or if you do that, do this, right? So suddenly, you know, my consistent 6:30 start to my day is not going to work, because I'm a night shift doctor, right? But what you do know is that 24 hours hasn't changed at all. What you are aware, there's nocturnal sleeping in there. So you've got your 16 cycles, your first cycle, you've got that set out like that. So all you do is you just, because you know in a biphasic, polyphasic sleep as humans before electric light, is this midday and late afternoon and nocturnal. So if you shift your five cycles, for example, your sleep, you shift that round into the space where the midday and early evening bit is, you're grabbing two natural recovery areas within the period where you're trying to sleep, right? Rather than doing it in a sort of random way of falling asleep as soon as you get home at 6 o'clock in the morning or something like that. You also know that around that sort of 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock cycle is, if you've got any opportunity to have your little 30-minute break there, that's where you get my 31-minute one in the afternoon, in the late afternoon. So you can get a much better dynamic about when you're doing something, why you're doing it, because it's the same sort of thing. It's still midnight, it's still sunrise, it's still midday, it's still there. And you sort of, you start to, you know, that you can, you know, black out your room to protect yourself from the outside light. But you'll need a little lamp next to your bed, a little dawn wake simulator that will recreate sunrise in that sense. Because all the lights in your home are nowhere near the same as daylight, right? So they don't trigger that response. So you can black
out.
We're
talking about what would be called lux, right? The intensity of the light, yeah?
The lux. So lux lamps. So if you are blacking out the room in the day to create that sort of, keep you in a melatonin world because that's produced, then what you do is you need a little light to sort of bring it. So when you open the curtains, there's light outside, but just to wake you up a bit more naturally. You've got those cycles to say, well, I'm going to do, you know, I can do four cycles, you know, say, you know, in the, from that fourth cycle of my day, I'll do that 4, 5, 6, but then I'll put the alarm on to wake myself out of it because I want to do another cycle, you know, two cycles before I go to work. So you just, it's the same 16 cycles.
Just offsetting it.
Yeah, and you've got a consistent start to your day at 6:30, but that's when you get home now. But it's still the start of a period, you know? It's still, so finish work first. So you just change that perception. So your consistent start to the day starts there is when you finish work. Now that's your evening. So what do you do in the first cycle? You're very conscious of not getting exposed to too much light and the blue light if you're trying to sleep, you know, at midday for 3 or 4 hours, because that's going to make it difficult. You've got to, so you just do exactly the same things, but you twist it around with exactly the same timings. So you don't start thinking, you know, you just look at it as if you've turned it around and you're just shifting things into other cycles. That's why it makes it so easy for people when they suddenly get asked, you know, 3 weeks of that sort of schedule, then they get a week off and then they're going to go back onto this schedule and they're not starting work till 2 o'clock through till, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning. Then they go on to one where they start at 7 o'clock in the morning and finish at 6 at night. And then they go on to one that starts at 12 and finishes at 7 in the morning. And you just go, the only way you can even think about rolling through something like that, it's a bit like having a new child in your life. It becomes very erratic. The only way you can think about that is if you know that when that happens, that's what you do, bing, bang, bong. And then when you go there, don't change it, right? Just because you're not doing that one anymore, it just rolls and morphs with you as you roll through them. And that's when you start to realize that little controlled recovery periods every 2 minutes, that little 30-minute period wherever you slot it in your day, about thinking about, it's probably better for me to do 3 back-to-back daytime cycles, nocturnal cycles, and then grab another one there, not try to do them all at once, because that's going to put pressure on, you know, when am I going to see my friends? When am I going to do this? When am I going to do that? So it's not about reducing the amount of recovery you need, but you can certainly use it to develop a more defined approach with confidence. And because that I think is what, from my own experience, is really the one that that really affects shift workers more than anything else, is they just feel like they're always working and they never feel as though they ever get the opportunity to live anything like a normal life, because if they're not working, they're in a bedroom with the curtains shut sleeping and other people at work, so they can't see the friends, and then they go to work when they come home and they can't go for meals, they can't go to the cinema, and it just becomes a major problem. It was certainly apparent in this police force. It's just nuts, absolutely nuts.
There's talk that the creation of blue light now over the last sort of 10 years, it's still the research is not really been enough yet to unearth the effect that blue light has on our bodies as a normal light bulb would have done. Are there any issues that you've come across with any of your clients or people that you talk to about the effects of blue light? There's always is it cliche to say that blue light affects your sleeping habits if you're on your phone, for instance, before you go to bed? Is there anything in there that is true or false, or what's the sort of accuracy with that?
It's both. Suddenly we start talking about light, blue light. And the reason we start talking about blue light, just out of the blue, excuse the pun, but is because we're all on our devices and we've got screens in front of us and we're all besotted with it and we're on it till late at night. So how do you get people to manage their exposure to technology? How do you get people to shut, don't leave the laptop open on the bed? How do you get people to sort of like in the final bit before you're going to sleep? These are some of the fundamental things. And all this blue light that's coming off your technology, let me tell you what it is. It creates serotonin in your brain. And the brain is then told to be awake. So if you're on these devices and you're exposing yourself to the blue light, then you'll struggle to get to sleep. So try and shut it down. Right. Well, that doesn't work. Okay. We'll give you some blue blocker glasses. So you can put those on. It'll block you from the light coming off your device. Right. And it'll mean you can still work. You can still play games and social media on your tech right up until you want to go to sleep, but you're not producing any serotonin. So you should sleep better. Hang on a minute. I want to stop you being on this all day long. I don't want you to put these on that keeps it going. In fact, can you just show me how much blue light's coming off this laptop? How much of that light? How much blue light do I need to be exposed to create that serotonin to keep me awake? Because I haven't got any blue light meter. Does it come with the instructions in the laptops and the devices that this thing emits this amount of blue light, and if you expose yourself to this for 10 minutes, you'll create enough serotonin to keep you awake for a week? You know what I mean? None of that. It's just more to do with trying to manage our relationship. Because of that, blue light is the most amazing, fundamental, free energy in daylight. It's the blue energy wave of daylight. And that blue energy wave wanders into your light receptors behind your eyes, triggers a little gland in your brain called the pineal gland, and that produces serotonin. And serotonin tells your brain to unsuppress everything and be active. It's your happy hormone. It's your active hormone. It balances everything you do and think about. You take the blue light away, sunset, and that's not in firelight, yellow light, red light, gas light, all that sort of stuff. It's only, we've created it in tech, but it's actually in the sun. You take that away and that same pineal gland produces melatonin. And melatonin tells the brain to suppress everything. Now, neither hormone makes the brain do it. It just gives it the information that this is what we should be doing at this point in that 24 hours. So the first thing, as soon as I started hearing that, is you're now making people fearful of blue light. I've had blue light protectors on all of my devices. You can download things, There's no blue light coming off my devices. And if I sit, here, or I sit here, then all you need to do is just get yourself... I did it with a young bunch of athletes. Are you recording this video? Is me putting this up ridiculous, or should I just explain what it is?
Yeah, explain what it is as well.
Okay. So all I did was what we want to try and do is to get you to think about the first cycle of your day, rolling through these 16 cycles, all the little things that we're doing. So when we get round to this particular point, like that particular cycle, 15, you know, what we want to be, you know, 12, what we want to be thinking about is doing these sort of activities, not those, right? Because that's what we want. So, and the reason for that is, so let's try and make sure that you love blue light, not be think it's bad for you, right? I'm more worried about how much you spend on social media right up until you try and go to sleep. That ain't going to help the brain. So into the app store, downloaded a free light meter, Lux light meter, like you said before. It put a very simple dial on my phone using the camera. And it's just basically nothing scientific. It's just measuring the amount of light around me, right? And it's called a free Lux light meter. You can get digital versions. You can get sci-fi versions. You get all sorts of things. But initially, I just wanted to give somebody an opportunity to understand what this means, right? So if we're outside all the time, sun up, midday, sunset, the sun, the daylight can be measured anything from 80 to 100,000 lux. Right? It's not damaging. The ultraviolet rays are. It's not damaging. It's just the strength of that light and the breadth of it. So in the first two phases of the day, from sunrise, midday, sunset, we'd be exposed to around 100,000 lux. Our average exposure in the first two phases would be around 10,000 lux because we're moving around. Clouds, trees, it's the light receptors that trigger it. So that's what we sort of look at, is around 10,000, because you're exposed to 100. So if you started to think that in the first two phases of your day, to keep yourself at your best, you would want to be at least thinking of an average of about 1,000 lux every cycle, right? An average. So that you've got yourself a bit of a balance. So your average through that period, you know, might be 8, 9, 10,000 lux or more, right? But you've got to get an idea of what that means. So very, very quickly, we just sat in here in the office, and where you're sat right now is melatonin land, okay? In your office, I can see it, even though you've got a spotlight above your head, right? And so I'm just sat here in front of the laptop. It's a lovely day. There is the garden, no curtains. And while I'm sat here, it's measuring 380 lux. Move it just there, 500, 400 lux. All right, if I just move back a bit, 250. Right up close to that, hardly changes. Still like about 300, 400 lux average where I'm sat. Now, if I just put this by the window, right, which is hardly an arm's width away, and I'm still not outside, just by the window, it's measuring 4,000 to 5,000 lux. And that's just over there. Right? If I stepped outside, it could be 79,000 lux right now on the other side of that glass. Not the other side of those curtains, the other side of that glass. So what you get is, if I sit here, right, and I'm working away, doing stuff, it's quite bright, there's lights up here, I'm in no more than 300 or 400 lux. That means all my brain is doing is producing melatonin, not serotonin. That means I'm trying to be active. I'm trying to do things. But all the time, my brain's getting told to suppress. So it's constantly adapting. You're pushing the boundaries. Right. If I just every now and again within any cycle, maybe the kitchen where I can fill up the hydration bottle is by a window, right? Just go and stand there, fill your hydration bottle up and just stand there because that's 4,500 lux kicking off right there. And we know that this triggers quite quickly. It's not like 15, 20 minutes. You know, just 5 minutes next to that, or like you can see on my desk, my other desk over there, there's a desk lamp, right? And that emits 10,000 lux, right? So just switch that on and that'll just run for 5 minutes. And I'm still working away, but that level of light is keeping the serotonin level up. and keep a nice balance and all that sort of stuff. So it's not always about you've got to be outside. But what you do know is that it doesn't matter about things if you don't know what you're trying to achieve. And if you've been underexposed all day, just sitting in front of a device is only going to make any difference, right? It's more to do with the other things because you've underexposed. If you've overexposed, there's no point putting blue blockers on. You know what I mean? So you can use stuff like wearing blue blockers when you shift through the seasons so you don't overexpose yourself to light, because it's going to be like this till 10 o'clock at night. And it wasn't like that 3 weeks ago. So it's kind of, yes, we can use things that we develop and everything else, but the first thing you should remember, you ain't going nowhere unless you get blue light into your brain, unsuppress everything, and get you active. That's what triggers it. Not moving straight from a dark room into another diminished light room. And that's when it gets a bit scary, when suddenly you realize that with literally a meter either side of you is the difference between charging your back brain up and not. And if you relate that back to any sort of devices, you know, I think we're all very much aware that probably I'm more interested in my portable charger than my phone. Because when I move, I'm not looking for plug sockets anymore. I'm not looking for anything. It's just, you know, that charger keeps that phone going wherever I am, whatever I'm doing, isn't it? So it's kind of trying to, I think one thing, you know, waffling on a bit, there's one thing to say, maybe one day, and in this world, probably tomorrow, I will be able to take a profile, looking into my camera onto my device, my smart device, whatever it might be, and that will be able to pick up an image of my brain, right? Just looking into the camera onto my phone. And it will show me that my brain is like lit up. And so there it is, fully lit up and functional. If I sit here for 20 minutes in this level of light, it's just diminishing. And bits are starting to shut down. They're not glowing anymore. You know? Just stand over by the window for 5 minutes, bing, it's all lit up again. It's kind of,
it's like the deluxe level is your human charger almost.
Yeah. And it's sort of like, that's why it's so important when you get that sort of rhythm, the cycles, and you start to bring it down to what do I do in the first cycle of my day? I forget about what happens while I was asleep. That's gone. What I do is I need that lamp by the side of my bed to bring 10,000 lux into the bedroom before I open the curtains, because it's difficult to wake up in the dark. And I can't not have the curtains because sometimes the sun comes up at 4 o'clock. And then sometimes it comes up later. So I have to manage daylight saving time every year, don't I? So there's the lamp, lux. I've got a little lamp in the kitchen. So while I'm sat there eating my breakfast, not about the lights in the kitchen, everything else, there it is, giving me a hit. Get outside every single chance you get, right? Change, go left instead of right. It's like me, but you know, like those, it's like those blue, what are they? Those blue lamps people have in restaurants to attract the flies and stuff like that. It's like, what you do is you get this radar for light, right? So everywhere you're going, it just becomes subconscious that you sit there on the bus. You sit there. I sit at that desk, not this one. And everywhere you go, it's sort of, you know, if you're walking through a building, you're still going from A to B, well, go that way, because you walk past the windows, you know? And suddenly you get that really strong relationship with, that's really one of the fundamental things about keeping synchronized, keep some recovery rhythm, because that will really help you and your brain when you do try to, you know, to get that sleep and get that quality of it. That's what you need to do, because that really helps it. And then when you know that diminished light is where I'm sat right now, right? I can be sat here being active, doing things for myself or working, knowing that it's my phase three. And now while I'm here, I'm producing that melatonin. My brain's been told to suppress. So ultimately, I'll just get to that point, and that point, and then off I'll go to sleep. Well, because I'm in that world where a lot of people would not have any concept that where you're sat right now is actually a melatonin environment that's trying to suppress you. You just wouldn't think of it like that. So when you flick the coin the other way around, suddenly you go, wow, that's amazing. And there's little, when you said human charger, I've actually got one in my box, but it's just like a little nanopod type thing, you know, that Bluetooths to earpods. And it literally uses the ear canal to send 10,000 lux down the ear canal to those light receptors. And you can be riding a bike. You can be on the treadmill. You can be anywhere, because they're just little earpods putting the light down into that same receptors and giving you that balance.
So essentially what you're doing is you're trying to agitate, consciously agitate the hormones in your body for positive effect or not, as it would be. You're trying to manipulate, you're consciously trying to manipulate them rather than just allowing life to do that for you and not really knowing whether you're where you are, that you feel tired when you should feel awake or you feel awake when you should feel tired. It's taking that conscious decision to understand that if I get into light, that will produce serotonin. It will give me a greater alert state than if I wasn't. And you have a choice to do that or not.
Yeah. Yeah. That's eloquently put, better than me. It's literally that, you know, there is no point asking your brain to try and give you great recovery after your day and everything else if it's been in constant battle with the natural rhythms of that day. And it'll just always struggle. And that's why most people always feel unrefreshed, but they'll get themselves into the day. It's not a performance criteria, but it certainly starts to become a performance, because, you know, decision-making, the list is endless. Mood, motivation, confidence, appetite, how you deal with fuel and fluids, exercise, alertness, all of these normal human functionalities are so related to that hormone, those two hormones, and that's how they are produced. And when you know that and you think about the kind of levels, then you really get into a place where that's what I say before. Suddenly, if you can just manage your exposure a little better, you know, if I spend 3 or 4 hours, you know, talking to you here, I'm already conscious, right? That if I keep talking anymore, I am already deteriorating, right? I'm re-emphasizing, I'm losing clarity. I'm answering questions too long when they could be quicker, right? I'm not saying some of the things that I actually should because they've drifted, right? So you suddenly become very, very conscious of what it feels like if you're charged up. And I think if anybody wants to maybe put that in another way, if you're inside for any period of time and you suddenly step outside, whatever the weather, you know, a deep breath, the fresh air, and it suddenly feels, oh, that feels good. You wander down and sit by a river in a park, by the coast, you know, take a walk through the park to go and fetch your lunch. And it's like, whew, that feels good. Well, yes, it's a bit like being outside rather than inside. Yes, it's probably the nice fresh air rather than the stale air. Yes, But we also know that this process happens much quicker than they ever thought it did. Right? They might think 15, 20 minutes. They think it's much, much quicker. Right? So there's a little bit of that. You're plugging me in. And so mental health and well-being, anxiety, stress, things go wrong. How do you deal with it? Things go right. How do you take advantage of it? How does this all impact on you? Well, it's going to have a much more profound impact. If I've been sat here for 2 hours in 300 lux, then if I'd got my levels up and was feeding off the serotonin, now I'm going to react to things in a far different way, right? And so that's really, you know, worrying about sleep is its biggest disruptor. And that's why when you get to trying to sleep, these things are really fundamental. It's about the cycles of when you're awake. That's what you want to be concentrating on.
Mate, I've absolutely thoroughly enjoyed talking to you and learning about sleep in a different way. I also know that I've taken up one of your cycles today. So, yeah. And appreciate that you need to go and top up on your lux as well. So, yeah. Nick, I very much thank you for your time today. It's been fascinating to talk to you. And genuinely, I've learned an absolute heap. And you've got a really great way of simplifying the process, for which I thank. So thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.